Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Departures from divine mandate in these strange times? I didn't have time to find a guest or two to discuss what happened on Tuesday. There will be plenty in the coming weeks. But I do have some thoughts of my own, which I'll share. And then we'll hear from Dahlia Scheinlin on a frightening topic, public opinion in Israel, and from James Foley and Vladimir Unkovsky-Koritsa on the role Ukraine plays in the politics of the West. First, the miserable election. I often say that the political problem of the Democrats is that they're a party of capital that has to pretend otherwise for electoral reasons. This time they hardly pretended. Kamala Harris preferred campaigning with the inexplicably famous mago Mark Cuban and the ghoulish Liz Cheney to campaigning with Sean Fain, who led the United Auto Workers to the greatest strike victory in decades. Those associations telegraphed both her policy instincts and her demographic targeting, Silicon Valley and upscale suburbs. Like Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, it failed, only worse. At least Hillary won the popular vote by almost 3 million. Harris lost by 5 million. She lost among suburban white women, a principal target of this twice-failed strategy. Like any major historical event, this loss has many explanations. Preceding her disastrous campaign, there was the bizarre nature of her nomination. White House staff hid the severity of Biden's brain rot for his entire presidency until his disastrous debate performance against Trump made it impossible to sustain the fiction of his mental competence any longer. There was no primary, and after a delusional bout of enthusiasm, we were quickly reminded why Harris crashed as a candidate in 2020. There was also the unwavering support for Israel's genocidal war, which probably wasn't decisive, but certainly cost her some votes. One explanation making the rounds needs to be squashed, that Harris was too liberal. Supporting that claim is a September New York Times Siena College poll that found 47% of likely voters viewed her as too liberal, compared with 32% who saw Trump as too conservative. It's not clear what those words mean to the broad public, or how too liberal applies to an ex-prosecutor who treated venture capitalists as a core constituency. Maybe having dark skin and being from San Francisco was all that was needed. The exit polls tell a different story, with 46% calling Harris too extreme and 55% applying the label to Trump. But that probably won't stop a good bit of the Democratic leadership and their worthless consultants from urging a move to the right to counter Trumpism. There's a lot of grim news in the exit polls. Dems' attempts to portray Trump as a bigot, nativist, and would-be dictator, not inaccurately, missed some of their targets. Trump got a third of the non-white vote, a share heavily boosted by Latino men, a group he won by a 10-point margin. In 2020, Biden won them by 23 points. And by what measures we have of class, Trump won the proletariat. He carried those without a college degree, over half of all voters, by 14 points. Harris carried those with a bachelor's or more by 13. Harris carried households with incomes over $100,000 by 5 points. Trump won those under $100,000 by 4 points. That's a complete reversal of 2020, when Biden carried the under 100s by 13 points and Trump the overs by 12. Harris prevailed among households with a union member by just 8 points, half Biden's margin in 2020. What were the issues that mattered to voters? One of the most salient issues on their minds was something Dems evaded for 3 years, inflation. More than 1 in 5 voters, 22%, said inflation had caused them severe hardship over the last year. They went for Trump by 50 points. More than half, 53%, said inflation had caused them moderate hardship. They went for Trump by 6. A lucky quarter, 24%, said it caused them no hardship at all. They went for Harris by 57 points. It's safe to guess that the no hardship crowd was firmly upper income. Answers to Reagan's classic question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, were bad news for Harris. A quarter said they were, and they went for Harris by 68 points. But almost twice as many, nearly half, said they weren't, and they went for Trump by 64 points, accounting for almost three-quarters of his votes. And those economic evaluations mattered. A third of voters said the state of the economy was the most important factor in deciding how they voted, and they went for Trump by 61 points. That's 3 times the share that chose immigration as the most important issue, and 8 times the share that said foreign policy. I wrote an article for Jacobin in September 22, arguing that inflation was a serious issue, one that liberals and leftists ignored to their peril. It was not well received. Inflation, it was explained to me, was a concern of the rich, even though, as I showed in the article, periods of high inflation result in declining real wages, with poorer households suffering more from rising prices than rich ones. I also argued that people experience inflation as psychologically destabilizing, fostering a sense that things are out of control, a frame of mind that leaves them open to the lures of an authoritarian strongman. Well, that certainly turned out to be true. On social media, I saw bizarre dismissals of concerns about inflation, with one prominent liberal economist blaming the media for promoting it, in particular newspaper owners who wanted their taxes cut under Trump, too. Did any of these economists ever buy a bag of groceries and recoil at the increased cost? Fighting inflation humanely is no simple task. Jacking up interest rates can cause immense distress among the unemployed. The polls have shown that people prefer higher unemployment to higher inflation, making the politics of the issue more complicated than you might think. But instead of denying inflation, they could have proposed some innovative remedies, like taxing the windfall profits corporations enjoyed by raising prices, or by taxing upper-income households to put a damper on the spending spree that drove up prices of cars and appliances that were in short supply during the COVID crisis. That would have been politically difficult, but denying the problem proved to be politically suicidal. Funnily, though, inflation could prove to be Trump's undoing. If he makes good on his promises to impose tariffs of 20%, or 60%, or 100%, depending on his mood, on imports, that could raise prices massively, to use one of his favorite words, and depress economic activity. He might even bring back stagflation, the combination of stagnant growth and high inflation that plagued the economy of the 1970s. But, as they say on Wall Street, never predict anything, especially the future. The task right now is to understand what just happened. Inflation was a very large part of it, and all those damn experts who dismissed it should don sackcloth and ashes and engage in rituals of public self-humiliation. Now for some other voices. It may seem odd to begin with a survey of Israeli public opinion, but it and the U.S. are deeply bound to each other, and life under the increasingly authoritarian Benjamin Netanyahu is a likely foretaste of our next 4 years. And if we want to understand what's driving Israel's genocidal war, it's important to understand the thinking of the society behind it. Here with more is Dalia Scheinlin. She's a columnist for Haaretz, where she writes mainly about Israeli public opinion. Her book, The Crooked Timber of Democracy in Israel, was published last year by De Gruyter. Dalia Scheinlin. How do Israelis process the destruction in Gaza and now South Lebanon? Are they aware and approve? Do they activate various modes of denial where they sort of know and sort of don't know? Yeah, how do they do it?
I think it's difficult to start with an assumption that Israelis as a whole are sitting around processing the destruction in Gaza. There are, let's say, the hardliners in Israel who are basically the supporters of this government who are aware and who are pleased about it and who think that this is the just response to what happened on October 7th and also an opportunity for Israel to conquer Gaza, essentially. This is being said very, very openly. Among the rest of Israelis, now remember, it's not a majority right now who support the Israeli government, particularly in these kinds of plans. It's a minority, but it's a significant minority. Having said that, the rest of Israelis, and that would include Jewish and Arab Israelis or Palestinian citizens of Israel, are dealing with these things in different ways. So let's say the Jewish Israelis who don't support this government, I still wouldn't say that they're sitting all the time thinking about the destruction in Gaza and Lebanon. For one thing, they're very, very consumed by the hostage issue, and that is top priority on their mind. It's much more prominent for them than the destruction in Gaza, than the destruction of people's lives in Gaza, than the accusations against Israel. If they look at those accusations, they see them as a matter of accusations, not actually reflecting either the reality or the justifications. For those people, again, the majority of Israelis, and we're talking about, I would say about 55% at this point who disagree with the government, they are seeing the destruction of Gaza as lower priority to getting their hostages back. They're consumed also by their anger at the government, by not trusting the government and particularly Netanyahu in his aims for the war. And so that does lead to critique of the government and the war. I have to admit that for the Jewish population, it does not come first and foremost from a sense of horror over what's happening in Gaza. Now, I will say that beneath all of those, the first priorities, I do hear Israelis saying, you know, it's a shame that there are civilians who are getting killed and they are aware that there are Palestinians are paying a terrible price. These attitudes go hand in hand with a strong sense that is widespread among Israelis, including those who don't support the current government, that Israel had to respond in a very harsh way. What happened on October 7th leaves no doubt in their minds that all of Palestinian society is somehow implicated, which is, of course, not the case. That's a matter of supporting collective punishment. But Israelis see that, you know, they're living in a kind of Hobbesian world in which it's survival of the fittest, to mix, you know, Hobbesian and Darwinian metaphors, and that Israel is fighting a war of existential survival. And it's a shame for the destruction of innocence, but this is the reality. It's Israel's survival versus theirs. I think that is widespread among Israeli Jews, no matter which side of their political map they're on. And of course, for Palestinian citizens of Israel, it's exactly the opposite. Everything to do with this war, they hold completely opposite views from the Israeli Jewish population. They are against this war. They support a ceasefire. They are almost a consensus of them support a hostage release ceasefire deal. And they continue to support long-term political resolution like a two-state solution. So they're typically in a very lonely position in Israeli society.
When you say 55% don't support the government, I guess you mean if the Jewish population doesn't support the government. From what perspective are they not supporting the government? Is it from the right, from the left? Is there an Israeli left to speak of?
First of all, I was talking about all of Israeli society. When I want to specify Israeli Jews, I'll say so, because we do have to, you know, remember that all Israeli citizens are Israeli society. When I say 55%, it's very much a ballpark figure. And the reason is because we have different kinds of measures and polls. We talk about people who are either voting for the parties of the original coalition. I say original because the coalition keeps changing shape. But the original coalition includes Netanyahu's party, the Likud, and very, very far-right, extremist, ultra-nationalist, religious fundamentalist parties. And there have been additional parties that have joined the coalition, but I'm talking about that original extreme right-wing government. It has not been able to go beyond 52 to 54, maybe 56, but for the most part in the low 50 seat range in any survey throughout this time out of 120 seats in parliament. And so I say, you know, that's why I'm saying they have a large minority of votes, but all the rest of Israelis who answer polls, and that includes Jewish and Palestinian citizens, are not supporting them in polls. That's what I mean. Now, I also take that figure roughly from the percentage of a conservative estimate of the percentage of Israelis who support a hostage release deal. Why do I use that as a proxy measure? Because most of the time when surveys ask, do you support a hostage release deal, it is in return for a ceasefire, and it is often balanced against, do you support a hostage release deal and a ceasefire, or do you prefer whatever the government is proposing at the time, such as back in April, for example, escalating into Operation Rafah. And so when we see that at the lowest range, about 55% of Israelis support a hostage deal in almost any circumstance, oftentimes the number is higher. The number can go to 65 or 70%. On occasion, very rarely, it's a plurality of the upper 40% range. And that's a matter of all Israeli respondents. And so I sort of combine those two measures. One is a long-term measure of the elections. The other is a particular kind of, let's say, a proxy question that deals with people's attitudes towards the government and the war, and people preferring the policy that the government is not doing by a majority consistently over time. I think that a lot of this stems from here distinguishing between the Jewish population and the Arab population of Israel. Those Jewish Israelis who are against the government, they think that ultimately Netanyahu is responsible. He is responsible for the chaotic and extremist government that was interfering and trying to undermine Israel's democratic institutions, particularly the judiciary, creating a level of social weakness and chaos and backlash in order to advance the aims of permanent annexation and establishing theocratic Israel. And that created such chaos in society that it contributed to Hamas's decision, certainly about the timing, to attack. And it also meant the government was focused exclusively on those plans at the expense of detecting and preventing the attack that Hamas had been planning. And so Israelis blame the Netanyahu and his government for the failure to detect, prevent, and then cope and respond to October 7th. And they don't trust the government's management of the war since then. It's not that they're left-wing. There is a portion of Israelis who are left-wing, but among the Jewish population, it's small. It's about 12 to 14%, as it has been for many, many years. And all the rest are saying Netanyahu is simply placing personal interest, his political interest in staying in power, first. He's placing his political interest first, and that is driving his decisions about how to manage this war. That is driving his decision to continue the war, even at the expense of hostages dying ever since the first hostage release deal in late November. And we've seen, you know, absolutely wrenching situations of hostages being killed and dying, knowing that they would have been on the list of people to be released had the negotiations led to a deal. But Netanyahu has preferred to be in complete lockstep with his coalition partners, who openly advocate day in, day out, and have been since the beginning of the war, that this must be an opportunity for a sort of messianic redemption of Israel conquering, annexing, and controlling both the West Bank, of course, and Gaza Strip, and rebuilding settlements there. Netanyahu is often seen, I think wrongly, as being dragged along or trapped by these coalition partners. I think that it's time to dispel this image. Netanyahu has made his choice. He put these figures into government. In some ways, he helped them win the power that they have. He put them into government. He made them his partners. Whether or not he completely agrees with them ideologically is beside the point. For whatever considerations, he is absolutely symbiotic with those aims, and he has chosen to preference those aims, to prioritize those aims over reaching a ceasefire, getting the hostages released, and possibly even taking excellent deals that the U.S. president has offered for longer-term resolution of this conflict. Now, Israelis had very mixed feelings about those kinds of resolutions of the conflict, the longer-term issues, a two-state solution. Again, the left wing completely supports that, and that is 20% of the entire Israeli population. And even parts of the center support it. About half of the center currently support it, let's say 40% to half. But the point is, the much more widespread sentiment among those who oppose the government is that they simply don't trust Netanyahu's aims, and they do not support this aim of conquering Gaza and rebuilding settlements, or even, you know, at the service of religious fundamentalists.
What about the day after, as they say? People talk about the general's plan to empty northern Gaza and, God knows what, turn it over to settlers? Turn it into a resort? I don't know. But what are the plans? What do people think about that?
Yeah, it's hard to know, again, what people think about it without, like, hard data on that particular question. This plan is definitely being discussed, okay, and there is a lot of controversy about it. And, you know, again, to reiterate, the plan has been developed by a number of former security officials, including most prominently the former head of the National Security Council, Giora Eilen, who has advocated for evacuating up to 300,000 to 400,000 Palestinians, civilians from northern Gaza, and if they don't leave, pressuring them through a kind of siege, including stopping all humanitarian aid. And
they're already pretty much doing that.
They're pretty much doing it, exactly, and, you know, and expelling them. Theoretically, you know, he argues, his perspective is that in order to sort of smoke out those who would remain, who are clearly terrorists, which Israel can just kill. But the reality is that they are forcing the expulsion of hundreds of thousands of people, and those who have not left, who cannot leave or who do not want to leave because expelling civilians is, in many situations, a war crime, they are then tormenting them by ceasing all humanitarian aid. So Israelis, I think, are hearing the debates about it. What I have noticed is that there are people who are already conscience-stricken by both the Netanyahu government's actions, by the ongoing war, by the failure to release hostages, by the international accusations. And again, they are more on the left side of the map, and to some extent leaking into the mainstream as well, that there is a problem, that, you know, Israel can only withstand the criticism or the accusations of very severe war crimes or, of course, the genocide case at the International Court of Justice for so long. And those people are really paying more attention to what's going on in the north and saying this absolutely borders on war crimes, or it may very well be war crimes, and it has to stop. They are still, I would say, individual voices. And I don't want to overstate the case that it's some sort of widespread movement, but we are seeing, for example, citizen-driven petitions that have hundreds or thousands of signatures. The government is already reacting against that kind of thing, trying to pass laws that would take punitive measures against people who call for sanctions, for example, against Israel. But these are coming from within Israeli society. Again, I can't overstate the case because it's really a very small portion. It's not even a portion. It's just, you know, a large number of individuals who are probably already associated with the left and even some of the mainstream. But it is beyond the far left, I would say. It's certainly more coming from people who, for example, were prominent in the protests throughout 2023 to support democracy and reject the government's assault on the judiciary, which back in 2023, people saw as a completely separate issue from the question of occupation or the Palestinians. And it's some of those very same people who are now driving or sounding the alarm that Israel is committing indefensible actions in northern Gaza. And I would say among the general population, there's an increasing sense of confusion, probably is the best way I can say it. This is not exactly data-driven. It's just my understanding and my experience with Israeli society. What is Israel doing? Why is it not working to release the hostages? How long is the war going to go on? What is Israel actually doing that is generating such an outcry from around the world? You know, in the earlier part of the war, you know, Israeli Jews certainly were kind of tuning that out because they were consumed by their own grief. And many still are. It's worth remembering that many Israelis still are consumed by their own personal loss, people who died or were hostages or were wounded on October 7th, people who have died since then, you know, in the war, and people who are displaced, and people who don't know where to send their kids to school next year because they're still displaced, and people whose businesses have closed because they're in reserve duty. And in addition to that, they're being told all year, well, this is, you know, the international criticism is just the typical anti-Israel sentiment because Israel is defending itself And now there's this new or increasingly severe situation in northern Gaza. I wonder how many mainstream Israelis in the center or the right wing of the political map are viewing it as something, you know, substantively different than what they've come to tell themselves over the course of the year is just the typical anti-Israel sentiment around the world. And I say that paraphrasing how Israelis see it, not, you know, it's not my personal opinion. You know, in addition to all that, remember that the Israeli media environment, by choice, does not really show the worst scenes of devastation, and it makes it easier for Israelis to avoid seeing what they don't want to see. All the information is available. Everybody has a responsibility to know. You know, it's a touch of a button on everybody's cell phone, but people who are, again, searching for distraction or are genuinely dealing with day-to-day difficulties of this war, including, of course, rocket fire and missile attacks, et cetera, are finding ways not to see that stuff or simply to put it into a kind of category in their minds of like, you know, there's so many things going on. What am I personally supposed to do about this? I don't want to make excuses for it because, you know, what's going on in Gaza is really has crossed every line. But this is the reality of how Israeli society is coping with it.
I'm speaking with the Haaretz columnist Dalia Scheinwand. How does the Israeli population see the country's increasing isolation in the world? I mean, it has the support of the U.S. and European governments, of course, but younger people in those countries, especially younger Jews, which must really be a little painful to hear, are appalled by the country, and the entire global South is pretty much opposed. So how do Israelis read this increasing pariah status?
Yeah, I mean, it comes and goes in waves. There are times when, you know, when there are lots of stories about the possibility of, you know, for example, U.S. delaying weapons shipment or other countries that have announced some sort of a weapons slowdown or even ceasing weapons export. And so these kind of make fleeting headlines. I have to say, you know, there is a continuity here because Israelis are still more likely than not to say, oh, you know, the world has always been against us and there's nothing new. And as soon as Jews try to defend themselves, you know, we take particular kind of critique that nobody else takes. And so that is the analysis and explanation that they give, even if it worries them, when it comes to material things. But when it comes to, you know, what are the attitudes of young people in the U.S. and Europe? Yes, it is like a small piece of bigger stories about what's going on in the world. And even, like I said before, that those kinds of questions about where the rest of the world is are sort of lower priority for Israelis right now because they're very inward looking. There's been lots of coverage of the American elections in general. Israelis have weighed in various surveys about whether they want Donald Trump to win or Kamala Harris, but it's all in very big, broad brushstrokes. You know, again, they're not sitting around consumed by what the rest of the world thinks of them, even though it does trouble them. I know from conversations people raise it, they're worried about it. But is that going to be the top priority that they think about and that drives some sort of change in Israeli society? Not so much. And that's only because, again, over the years, over the decades, Israelis have told themselves, the world is always against us. It's nothing new. We're used to it. They're concerned, but there is a defeatist sense that this will always be the case. It's a matter of underlying anti-Semitism around the world or anti-Israel or simply, you know, it's convenient for the rest of the world to blame the Jews for stuff that everybody else gets away with. And we'll just have to survive on our own, you know, and that's a very dangerous way of thinking. But it is certainly very prominent in Israeli society because the whole idea that we have to just survive on our own, the world is always against us, leads them to kind of say, what's the point? There's no holds barred. What's the point of even trying to constrain ourselves? It troubles people, but at the very same time, it's something that they're accustomed to dealing with in a longer-term kind of way of thinking about Israel's position in the world.
How do you explain the preference for Trump? Biden has given Netanyahu everything he wanted and has been covering for Israel in the diplomatic sphere, in the UN, politically. Why still do they prefer Trump?
I don't like to attribute everything that is going wrong in Israel to Benjamin Netanyahu, but he has had a major role over the years on two levels in advancing the idea that Republican presidencies are better for Israel. One was his unrelenting assault on the Obama presidency and on Obama himself. I mean, he was vital for hammering home the idea day after day for 8 years that Obama was bad for Israel, which is really remarkable because under the Obama administration, of course, the president signed the most generous aid package to Israel in history, $3.8 billion a year for 10 years. And, you know, in all sorts of other ways, the Obama administration tried to advance, for example, negotiations for a long-term political resolution, which should be a good thing for Israel. But in Netanyahu's Israel, that's considered bad. It was really a very, very loud and constant drumbeat of Israeli society that the Obama administration is bad for Israel. That set into motion a kind of breaking of what had been a paradigm in American politics of bipartisan support for Israel. The idea that no matter who is president, America supports Israel. And Netanyahu really manipulated that into a completely different approach, which is to say that Republicans are good for Israel, Democrats are bad. So it goes back historically to the Obama years. Then when Trump became president, the Trump administration did so much to support Netanyahu's agenda, which Israelis considered, you know, in Israel's favor, that you often heard Israelis say, well, you know, he may be crazy, but boy, you have to admit he's really good for Israel. But what they meant by that was a series of steps that Trump took to strengthen the Israeli government's position, entrench Israel's control over most of the West Bank, and avoid ever dealing with resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now we're paying the price for that complacency. It's not just complacency. It was an attempt to really marginalize the issue, crush the idea of Palestinian self-determination. And it, you know, all of the various steps that the Trump administration took to do that, like moving the embassy to Jerusalem, which was a major breaking point with Palestinians, like signing the Abraham Accords, which Israelis thought was great, but which also allowed Israel to think it never had to touch the Palestinian issue again, like recognizing Israel's sovereignty in the Golan Heights, which is sovereign Syrian territory that Israel captured by force, violation of international law, but basically made Israel say, oh, we can do whatever we want. International law doesn't matter. We can conquer territory. These are the kinds of things that entrenched the ongoing conflict and occupation. Unresolved conflicts always escalate. People always pay the price. And so Netanyahu portrayed this, and Israelis saw it as extremely pro-Israel. They thought that on the surface, what Trump did was great for Israel, and therefore Republican presidents are good for Israel. What I think, you know, they're missing is that these ultimately fed into the underlying desperation of Palestinians that was certainly destined to lead to an escalation, even if the form it took is completely indefensible on October 7th. Many of us predicted that there would be major violent escalations without having any idea of something as egregious as October 7th, because we saw where this political emboldening of the Israeli agenda was leading. That's a long background to say that Israelis were well primed for years in advance to think of America in a partisan way. And then when the Biden administration comes around, it's just remarkable that despite this kind of blank check, bear hug, whatever metaphor you want to use, the Biden administration has given almost complete political military cover to Israel, support at every level, with only the tiniest little measures, you know, tiny incremental steps to say, well, you know, we can't actually let completely violent settler activity to go by totally unnoticed. We're going to sanction a few individuals who are responsible for violence, you know, against Palestinians in the occupied territories, and we're going to delay one weapons shipment while flooding Israel with weapons and the money to buy further weapons, backing Israel in the UN Security Council all this time. And nevertheless, Israelis worry that the Biden administration has not been good enough. And you hear them talking a great deal about the anti-Israel sentiment within the Democratic Party. They have been primed for years, and they have been seriously manipulated to think that somehow the Democratic administration has not been good for Israel, which reality is just so overwhelmingly the opposite. You know, as much as I generally don't see any public as sort of blindly manipulated, it really is an extraordinary contrast between Israeli images and the reality of what the Biden administration has done for Israel.
That was Dalia Scheinlein, a columnist at Haaretz and author of The Crooked Timber of Democracy in Israel. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back for a physical break. That was some of Sonatine by Pierre Boulez, performed by Claire Chase on flute and Jacob Greenberg on piano. Express some critical thoughts on U.S. and Western European support for Ukraine, and you immediately get denounced as a Putin apologist. I'm not. He's terrible. But the war in Ukraine has been horrendously bloody and politically very dangerous. What explains the bellicosity of the West, the refusal to contemplate negotiations? Here are some answers from James Foley and Vladimir Unkowski-Koritsa. They have an article in the academic journal Globalizations called Decentering the West, Civilizational Solidarity and Decolonization in Theories of the Russia-Ukraine War. The decolonial theories we talk about have become prominent in academic circles in recent years. They hold that we should purge the institutions and structures of thought that are features of the colonial era and take direction instead from the colonized. Foley teaches in the Department of Social Sciences at Glasgow Caledonian University and Unkowski-Koritsa in Central and East European Studies at the University of Glasgow. The first voice you'll hear will be Foley's. Could you lay out just how Ukraine has been analyzed in this decolonial framework before we get to the critical part?
It's perhaps useful to go back to the period in which all of this was happening. Obviously, we had come out of a set of circumstances where it was kind of post-George Floyd, and there was a critique of the whole history of our own Western-type civilizations that had crisscrossed much of intellectual life and was in some ways very polarizing and so on and so forth. So a number of the ideas come out of there. But the essence of what went on around Ukraine, I think, was that the framing of those ideas was repurposed in such a way as only Ukrainian narratives of the war, patriotic narratives specifically, should be centred, and that the story of the war should be told in terms of what was called Ukrainian voices. What that essentially did was to place upon Western observers a particular type of responsibility, where essentially their role was one of raising up the voices of Ukrainian struggle and combating what was perceived to be Russian disinformation. But as the narrative unfolded, the idea of what that disinformation would involve tended to expand further and further. And it became more and more not just about saying that we shouldn't critique military escalation or the role of NATO historically, but it became more like a sort of blanket policy of not raising any point of comparison with the historical problems, the historical complicity, the historical crimes of Western foreign policy in general. It evolved essentially from this critique that was specifically about saying that outsiders to the Ukrainian situation should stay out of the way and allow those with expertise on the national situation to articulate it in their own terms. You can see some level of justice behind why people might say that. But that became increasingly an essentialist argument, and also one that precluded a critique of the foreign policy priorities of our own states, which is where it became intellectually dangerous in a more general sense.
The Global South doesn't seem to feel much affinity with Ukraine's struggle. You know, the Global South is where decolonization happened. What do you say about that?
When we look at the decolonizing agenda, quite a lot of it follows on from real decolonizing processes in a lot of the Global South. They come from the overthrow of colonial rule, the retreat of empire, and then a subsequent discussion of how knowledges are to be decolonized. What's happened with the post-Soviet space is the argument that the knowledges that we have formed around the post-Soviet space have been framed largely through Russian imperial lenses. So we have to decolonize our knowledges from the Russian imperial gaze and valorize voices from the rest of the post-Soviet space, in other words, the subaltern voices. That project, as James was saying, went alongside a blindness to very real histories of Western empire and imperialism, such that scholars sitting in the West stopped being critical towards their own governments. Viewed from the Global South, such a process seems very much not to continue in the tradition of decolonization, because it's effectively telling the Global South that it should check its decolonized privilege almost. And that's obviously being treated with a high level of skepticism. And when we look at it historically, I just wanted to make a brief analogy to what's been happening in the last year or two. We've had two major global crises that dominate the news. One has been the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And on the other hand, there's obviously been Israel's war on Gaza, which has taken on a genocidal character. When we look at this historically, there was a similar moment around about 1956 when Soviet troops were used to put down a Hungarian uprising. The West was obviously very quick to condemn Soviet troops moving into Hungary, while at the same time, Britain and France were colluding with Israel to invade Egypt following its nationalization of the Suez Canal. That kind of activity in 1956 looks a lot like what's been happening in the last few years globally, with the United States aiding and abetting a genocide in one place and effectively being involved in another war in Ukraine, but washing its hands of it. To the global south, that looks basically like hypocrisy, and there's a high level of truth to that.
As you point out, the U.S. interest in bringing Ukraine into NATO actually predated Ukrainian interest in joining NATO. That history is forgotten in the decolonial narrative and all the cheerleading for Ukraine that's been going on in the West, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. The insistence of Western elites that Ukraine should be part of NATO is part of a broader history of NATO enlargement, which runs roughshod quite often over local views. I mean, I'm not saying that that's always been the case. There was genuine enthusiasm in some countries for joining NATO. However, it, in the Ukrainian case, predates any enthusiasm on the part of the population itself, which to some extent gives lie to that whole notion of listening to Ukrainian voices. We're only invited to listen to them when they say what we want them to say.
Part of the argument is that Ukraine is a way of solving some political conflicts within Western societies. What are those conflicts and how does Ukraine resolve them?
It might be useful to compare the Ukrainian moment of post-22 to the preceding political environment. And partly we did this, we used the term Ukrainian moment consciously to reflect what people were referring to as the populist moment that preceded it. And the essence of the way that political scientists and commentators and so on discussed Western polities at the time was essentially in terms of irrevocable cultural division, often taking anti-establishment, anti-state kind of politics. And people would talk about the sort of simultaneous rise of your Bernie Sanders and your Donald Trump, and there would be a sort of equivalent to that in almost every state in Europe and more broadly, right? So that was the general tenor of discussion that was going on at the time. And that kind of devolved quite quickly into sort of polarized cultural divisions that were invested with those energies. Some of these questions around race, about colonial history, also around gender and LGBTQ questions and so on, in what was often termed a cultural war. But the essence of that whole debate, of course, was irrevocable division. And that was the whole tenor of all political sociology of the period. And part of what motivated us to reflect on this kind of moment as being a peculiar moment of Western culture was precisely how quickly we went from that to this complete blanket unity and conformity that crisscrosses all these ideological divisions within the West. We're talking about everyone from Boris Johnson and Giorgia Meloni to John McDonnell and Bernie Sanders and AOC and even people further to the left, anarchists, Trotskyists. There's almost this complete sense of a total civilizational solidarity emerging from precisely these conditions of apparently permanent cultural division. The way it kind of works isn't that suddenly we all feel good directly about our own civilization, our own states and so on, and feel this nice cuddly sense of unity. What happened was we had to project outwards some of these energies that had been directed inwards to the idea of an external aggressor and evil from elsewhere, but also we had to get our idea of a sense of the good things that we see in our own civilization that we want to defend. We projected that vicariously onto the struggle of another people. Now, in doing so, of course, given that very few people in the West have very much prior understanding of Ukrainian civilization, internal divisions, and so on and so forth, one way or the other, we were always going to glob onto them our own values and assumptions and be guilty of all manner of essentialism. So you kind of see a process by which liberal elements of the, what you might call the culture war, are discussing the Ukrainian struggle in terms of a sort of environmentalist, LGBTQ-friendly type of imaginary. By contrast, your sort of more Giorgia Meloni-inclined populist right kind of people are seeing in it the defence of, you know, the white race from Asiatic menaces and all these other things. So it's not like we suddenly go from the conditions of the populist moment and all these divisions and so on into some sort of restored unity of civilization. It's more that there's a quite artful process by which people are able to find in the Ukrainian struggle something to identify with that essentially conforms to their own ideological views, critiques, and assumptions about their own civilization, more than anything, I think, that's much to do with Russia or Ukraine. It's probably worth noting that we're coming right out of things like Russiagate, out of the circumstances of Brexit, where many people blamed Russian foreign policy for the decisions of Brexit, and so on. So a lot of what we are doing here is essentially vicarious energies that are being projected onto this struggle and are, of course, involved quite dangerously in escalating it, to the point where many liberal commentators in my own country are very openly saying things like, anyone that doesn't fully support Ukraine openly and in public should be sacked from their job, that we should be willing to risk nuclear confrontation with Russia. All of this stuff kind of becomes very quickly par for the course in a sort of mad escalation. But very few people are analysing the unlikely bedfellows that are emerging out of this very fervid ideological moment.
That was the voice of James Foley, co-author of an article on the role of Ukraine in Western politics, with Vladimir Yonovsky-Kordytsa, whom we're also hearing from. Related to all this, of course, is the view of Putin as an evil demon. I mean, he's not a sweetheart by any means, so I'm not going to recommend him as a political model or anything. But it does seem there's an inflation of his, of just how precisely how demonic he is, how powerful he is. And relatedly, this story of Russian imperialism more generally. It's really hard to believe in a mighty Russian imperial force when they can't even conquer Ukraine. But there's a whole lot of that going around. What do you make of this view of Putin specifically and Russia more generally?
It's not the first time. Myself and Vlad referred to a process we call Munichization during the sort of drafting of the article, whereby various foreign policy enemies historically going back to Nasser have been identified as new Hitlers, new emergencies for us to confront as a civilization, as a process of mobilizing towards quite standard, you know, imperial foreign policy objectives. You could think of Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, and other people in recent times. What maybe does distinguish this, of course, is the degree to which it seems to put aside so many other ideological divisions internal to our civilization, while still allowing those ideological factions to have their cake and eat it. They still hate the conservative enemy or the liberal enemy. They just do so vicariously through projecting this onto Putin in different respects, right? So the enemy can mean all these different things. But I think it is symptomatic about Putin that we had already sort of started to blame him for many problems internal to our own civilization long prior to this. Obviously, we are talking now just as Donald Trump has won another election victory. It's interesting to maybe think about how liberals and other people who are shocked by that are going to respond. The way I remember the circumstances after the immediate aftermath of Brexit and Trump was that the initial reaction was one that was quite reflective about the failings of our own civilization, whether those of rampant inequality, of rampant globalization and liberalization over a concerted period, whether also, you know, the history of race and racial divisions in Western societies and so on. There was a sort of moment of self-critique that immediately followed these populist upsurges of 2016. But very quickly, this devolved into a process of blaming an external aggressor for problems that were clearly of the making of our own civilization in one form or another. So the role of Putin as an antagonist predates the very aggressive actions that he displayed in 2022. That fact in and of itself, I think, should be seen as symptomatic. None of which, of course, means that we need to apologise for Putin in any way. And this is why, of course, the thing is so frustrating, because, you know, myself and Vlad have always been supporters of the Russian anti-war movement. There is no way in which we are apologising for him any more than we would do for Saddam Hussein. You can say that and also admit that, you know, he is only as evil as others like Saddam Hussein were in the first circumstances. And we probably should have learned from everything that went on with the war on terror and its various disasters, that simply the fact that an enemy can be declared evil, a menace to their own people, a menace to their neighbours, an abuser of human rights and all sorts of other things, doesn't thereby mean that every foreign policy action that our own imperial states take in relation to that foreign policy enemy is going to work out well. It's just kind of shocking to me how few lessons the wider liberal commentariat in the West were able to learn from this, remembering that 2022 came mere months after the pullout from Afghanistan. Again, something that we just seem to learn no lessons from. When can we get to this situation where we can admit that there are evil actors in the world, but it doesn't mean to say that their evil is somehow going to overrun the whole of Europe in the way that the more lurid imaginings tended to suppose of Putin? I mean, the lesson of the first months of the conflict should have been that he couldn't even overrun Ukraine, far less that he could overrun all the countries of Eastern Europe and start to threaten the security of Western Europe, as people seem to imagine.
Vladimir, do you have anything to add to that?
What I would like to add to what James has just said is the contradiction when you think about it, with just an ounce more attention than the knee-jerk reactions, is that Putin failed to overrun Ukraine. He failed to take Kyiv in the first months of the war. And yet we were hearing about him being a threat to the rest of Europe and the wider world. But at the same time, his saber-rattling with nuclear weapons is something that we should not take seriously. There seems to be a kind of contradictory view of Putin as at the same time a new Hitler and as a paper tiger. And I think this is an incredibly dangerous and slippery slope, because we have seen red lines crossed over the last 20 years by the West in its eastward expansion of NATO, for example. The repeated crossing of red lines did ultimately lead to a major invasion and a major war. Somehow we're invited to forget all of this history and to simply excuse Western foreign policy as a response to a major threat. Now, as James was saying, I think we should go beyond accepting the moral panics of the moment and our own civilizational crises and introduce a level of history which can be quite instructive. And on that point, I think a major element of what's been happening is a devaluation of the Second World War as a usable memory across the board. The reference to Putin as a new Hitler is quite a dangerous one, because the historical comparison is incredibly superficial. Germany in the 1930s was a rising industrial power at a time when much of the Western world, for example, was in deep economic trouble. Russia, by contrast, today, and over the last 20 or 30 years, is a shadow of its former self. Russia, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, returned to its roughly 1,700 borders. If anything, it's Western military alliances that have been expanding around the world and indeed within Eastern Europe and into former Soviet territory. Russia in the 1990s saw a massive contraction of its economy, social standards, quality of life. So to present it as somehow an existential threat beyond, as it were, its potential to use such weapons as nuclear weapons, it just seems incredible. And the fact that you can present someone like Putin as a new Hitler devalues, I think, the historical comparison and the historical, well, the importance of understanding fascism, so much so, in fact, that at the same time as demonizing Putin as a new Hitler, we're whitewashing the existence of real fascist groups in Ukraine who have been growing in terms of their influence, like the Azov Battalion, which has been feted around Western Europe and North America as a glorious mode of resistance against Russia, but at the same time has been key to rehabilitating all sorts of unsavory anti-Semitic fascist characters from the Second World War. And I think that's a dangerous dynamic both within Russia itself and in Eastern Europe and in the West generally.
Finally, how do you read the divisions in U.S. politics around Ukraine? Democrats solidly pro-Ukraine. Establishment Republicans pretty pro-Ukraine. But Trump and his allies ready to pull the plug. Come January 20th, the external environment is going to change radically for Ukraine. So what do you make of the Trumpian dissension?
It's interesting because when we started writing the article, part of the atmosphere of uniformity that we detected around it was probably down to the time that Donald Trump seemed to be kind of down and out as a political force, even inside the Republicans, for a sort of period around 2022. It was a period where he was sort of embroiled in different types of legal trouble and all these other things. And there seemed to be a return to a establishment Republican type or even neocon type foreign policy analysis with respect to Russia that was prevailing at the time. Trump, I think, always presents it very ambiguously in terms of what he's actually going to do in foreign policy terms, and he will put different messages to different audiences, kind of willy-nilly. He is a difficult character to read. My impression of it, though, is that the war has been going so badly that it will be almost weirdly, I don't know if this is the right way of putting it, the Democrats would have not known how to get out of a conflict that they have started, but there is no real off-ramp for them that allows them to save face. And I'm not saying that this is an upside of Trump having won the election, but it does seem to me that he will have to do essentially some of the dirty work of American foreign policy and, you know, addressing the question of negotiations and some of the uglier compromises that nobody is going to like around territory, around the question of neutrality, and all these other things that we could have dealt with back in 2022 without the extraordinary amounts of bloodshed and destruction that have followed. It's going to be a terrible compromise one way or the other, and one in which nobody is going to get anything for any of the sacrifices that they have made that would in any way justify them. But it would have been very difficult for the Democrats to actually brook the necessary compromises that will allow them to get on with their various other foreign policy issues and disasters that they have started and the other emerging conflicts that they care about, whether in the Middle East or remembering that they're supposed to be pivoting towards the Pacific and to questions of China, Taiwan, and all these other things as well.
Vladimir, you want the last word?
I think in a curious way, Donald Trump will now be closer to, for example, the German Social Democrats in terms of his way of wanting to deal with Russia than he is to the US Democrats. And it is, after all, the US Democrats and the German Social Democrats who should be seen or are seen as natural political allies. Whereas it is likely to lead to a quicker end to this war, and the quicker it ends, I think, the better for everyone. The truth is that Trump isn't really doing this because he wants peace or he's particularly enamored of Vladimir Putin, although he may be. As James has said, the real pivot for the United States is a competition with China. The US has been wasting resources, as probably seen by a part of the US establishment in Europe, whereas it really should be thinking about the Chinese challenge. So I think that what we're really seeing is a possible end to one war in one area of the world in order for a new theatre of tension to open elsewhere. One of the major victims of this will be the Ukrainian people themselves, who have fought valiantly for their freedom, but who were encouraged to believe that a victory was possible against a much bigger enemy when that was very unlikely and a peace could have been done much earlier.
That was Vladimir Unkosky-Kuritsa. We've been listening to an interview with him and James Foley, co-authors of an article in the academic journal Globalizations called Decentering the West. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a song of no political resonance, some of Pressure Suit by Adult. Till next week, bye.